This is Kate Magruder. It is January 31st. I'm in Albion, California, recording an interview for Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Would you introduce yourself?
My name is River. I have, and that is, in fact, my last name, but I use it as my name, River. And there's a whole story behind that, which was basically a dream.
Where were you born and when?
1936, Washington, D.C.
And can you tell me some of the formative experiences or people that shaped you when you were growing up?
Okay, here we go. My father, people like people in all over the world, was born to a very dysfunctional family. And long, long story, obviously. How he saved himself and got saved was he fell in love with nature, like a lot of people get healed by nature. And he spent most of his childhood just wandering in Connecticut, in the woods, and learning about soil. And he eventually turned into a soil scientist for the Department of Agriculture, which is why Washington, D.C. He was a very, very gentle man. I unfortunately have, in my history, called my parents the father from heaven and the mother from hell. And it was kind of the way it was. My poor mother had been very abused. Didn't know, nobody talked about it. Nobody. But it turns out that that's what happened to her and why she turned so cold and so withdrawn and unhappy. Yep, that's about what I can say about that now.
How did that affect your choices?
Okay. Well, I wasn't very courageous. I basically was in the business of keeping safe. So I learned how to hide. And I became, yes, a very hidden person for the first 40 years of my life, more or less. And you might not notice that from a distance, but up close, it was really obvious. I just stayed in my room, read books, went to the woods. And fortunately, I lived somewhere where the woods were nearby, and I could go be with nature like my father did and feel whole. That's where I really lived, was up in the woods. And from my father, I just learned something about how to relax around that tension that so dominated our life.
After high school, what did you do?
I went to college. I was a good girl, you know. I did what we were supposed to do. I grew up, went to school, went to college, and was already betrothed before I ever went to college to a high school sweetheart. And by George, we got married and proceeded to have three sons.
So you got married, you had three sons. What then happened? What was it that propelled you out to the West Coast and eventually to Albion?
Well, one answer would be boredom. I just kept thinking, this is it. This is it. You grow up and then you live in an apartment and you have your first child and then you have another child and the apartment's too small, so you get a house. We got a house. But I kept having this question, is this it? You know, and had I been happily married, I think I wouldn't have asked the question, but I wasn't. And that was just a huge part of it all. I couldn't have said it. I don't think I would have allowed myself to even think that, of course I'm happy, I'm married. I have what I'm supposed to have. I have a husband and a house and kids, and I was miserable. Absolutely hated being a housewife. And I was terrible at it, you know? So coming up through that was a wish for something else. And I had no idea what form it would take. The first time I can remember thinking, huh, there's something else out there. There was something in the newspaper about the beat poets. And I read it and I went, holy shit, there are people who think and talk about these things that no one ever got near, you know, about what is it really all about. And that little flicker kind of kept me going for a long time. And I never had a plan, like when I get out of this marriage, I'm going to this, or I didn't have that much imagination, I guess, at that point. But the longing was there, even though I didn't know what it was for, except just to get away. And by George, my husband was an electrical engineer, and his work sent him to California in 1968 for a conference, and he was able to bring his wife, me, and there was San Francisco in 1968. And here were all these lovely people with flowers and We had heard of them, but we didn't know anything about hippies or what they were about or why they were doing it. But I knew immediately I was attracted. They looked happy. They weren't just going through a drudgery of whatever form. So that was quite important. We went to the conference. We went back home, and then we started saying, why don't we go to California? Why do we have to stay here just because we're here? And then people thought and told us that we were absolutely out of our minds because we decided to go to California with no plans, no job in store, just sell the house, get the money from that, from his retirement, and go. And that's what we did, and we didn't have any idea what was going to happen. I think we had fantasies of somehow we would magically turn into hippies without having any idea what that would mean. No experience with dope, nothing. Just these naive two little parents of three little boys. Oh, my God. Well, yeah, that's what happened. And we landed in Sausalito and right away knew we couldn't live in Sausalito because though we loved it, you either had to be really rich or a real hippie, and we were neither. But we ended up in Mendocino because my husband got a part-time, very short job helping to demolish one of the old flop houses in Fort Bragg. And he said, we got to go there. That's where we have to be. That's what got us to Mendocino. And then it was just one thing after another opened up. We knew nothing about people building their own homes. And this couple saw us and said, can we help you? And they were hippies, I think. I know that they had built a plastic house in the woods in Jackson State Forest. And they wanted us to see what they had done, and we did. And holy, I did not want to live in a plastic house with three boys and my husband at all. But that was kind of the beginning of it. We ended up buying a piece of land, deciding we would be homesteaders. We were not ready to be homesteaders, to put it mildly. We had none of the skills or at all.
What year was this, and where did you buy a piece of land?
It was 69, 70. And the land is in Albion.
And so what happened? When you bought this piece of land and you wanted to become homesteaders, did you indeed build on it? What happened?
Well, we started pretending that we were homesteaders. And we went around visiting other people who were doing it because we had no idea. You know, you just get a book and it says, put up a 2x4, you know, how does it work? So my way of looking at it was to go around and see people who were doing it and find out how it's done that way. And I did. And kind of a convoluted story, but it turned into a book. I made a book called Dwelling on Building Your Own. And that's because pretty early on, I ran into Robert Greenway, and he had a friend, Sherry Thomas, who lived on Middle Ridge Road, very close to Salmon Creek, what would become Salmon Creek Farm. And she said, you know, I know this guy, this professor at Sonoma State, and he wants to buy a piece of land and start another free school. He had done this once. He wanted to do it again. So he introduced us, and we were attracted to each other immediately. And without any forethought whatsoever, it was like, bingo, okay, this is my partner now. And it was as crazy as it sounds. Anyhow, he decided, yes, he wanted to be living in this area. So he found a piece of land in Albion, which is what became Salmon Creek Farm. And he purchased that. And I had no idea. I was just in love. And, oh, my God, thank God I can get away from that husband finally. And here's my wonderful excuse and all the usual, you know, stuff. And so the land was bought, and we started talking about how we were going to do it. And he said, well, I think we should have a commune. And I can remember that moment like steel jaws clamping around my I was just absolutely not at all interested in living. Me? I mean, I spent so much time alone to be with people I have to be with all the time. Holy shit, I can't do this. You know, that's what I thought, but I didn't say it. I just gulped, as in my usual gulping fashion, and little by little, people showed up. It was almost, it's not accidental, but there was no plan to it, you know. Robert knew a woman, Leona Walden, who's probably maybe in the book, I don't know, wonderful artist and person, and she had a partner, and they came, and little by little, folks came, mostly from Sonoma County, because that's where Robert was teaching. And then a couple of local people, and pretty soon we had this group of people and started doing the things about how do we have meetings. And that was totally revolutionary to me, that people could sit in a meeting with no ostensible leader and work things out. And it wasn't that way initially, to be sure. It took a while before we went, hey, wait, we have to be able to have a meeting without getting mad at each other and yelling at each other and all that. It doesn't have to be that way somehow, but we didn't know how. And for myself, I learned how by getting involved in my political action had to do with anti-nuclear work. Because when I learned about that, I just went completely dove into it. What in the world are we thinking? And the People Abalone Alliance was pretty much the center of that work here. Not here, but on the West Coast. And they taught everybody that wanted to be involved this meeting way and some other stuff, because we had to be working things out with what were we going to do when we were in jail, and were we going to work with these people or those, and all of that stuff.
Let's go back into creating Salmon Creek Farm. And did you have your three boys with you? Were you raising children on the farm?
Yes. And Robert had four kids, only two of whom were part of it. So for a long time, 6 years, there was, the commune included, seven little boys, not all very little. The youngest was my youngest, Dan, who was seven. And Robert's kids, yeah, they were all there, but Robert's daughter, she didn't ever come and be a part of it. And they were all part of the mix. It took us a while. I remember one day we had a meeting about something. It could have been about the choice of house sites, which was a real issue for a while. It's like, wait a minute, what do the kids want? And that was a real huge one, because it was like, we never thought of it before. These are the grown-ups, and they make the decisions, and the kids go along. And they did, but when we gave them the opportunity to pass the power object and speak, it was stunning, absolutely stunning what they would come up with, that they had thought about. You know, how come you get to choose that house site, but I can't? Is it because I'm little? Is it because I'm dumb? Do you not care? All of that. And it was, I've got shivers in my shoulders remembering that whole thing, because it was so enlightening and so painful to think how we could overlook our own kids. So they taught us a great deal. And they built, two of them built their own cabins there. And I'm happy to say that they both still say it was one of the happiest things they ever did, because they just loved figuring out how to do it and where to get, you know, could we, the old farm down there, contribute some of the old wood, barn wood. And it was just, I want to say, a perfect creative experience for them, really was. And there were people who could help them, and did, so they weren't standing there with their 2x4 all alone.
How were relationships between men and women, sexual relationships, how were those dynamics worked out in a communal setting, especially with people who were young and full of life and vitality?
It was pretty messy. I, for one, simply wanted to be partnered with Robert, and that was that. I didn't want any other monkey business at all. I should have known better, I was warned, but did I heed the warnings? No, I didn't. I lived in the fantasy that we were perfect for each other forever, et cetera, et cetera. Wrong. For the rest of it, there were several couples who were couples when they came, and no couple left that as a couple. I learned that this is what happened with hippies. You sort of went with what was happening. At least that's how it felt to me. And it was unnerving a bit. I remember one of my sons, it must have been Josh, that just happened to walk into somebody's cabin when somebody was making out with somebody else. And he came and told me, he said, do you know what? Okay. I can't even remember. I probably don't want to remember what the conversation went like. But they were very aware that there was all kinds of sexuality going on. Much more aware than I was, until it finally dawned on me that this is what was happening. Why would it not be happening? It was happening everywhere else. And I was uneasy with it, but I was pretty uneasy anyway. You know, that was just one more layer of it.
Did you write?
Not a whole lot. I had never even thought of doing writing as anything other than kind of a lightweight. hobby for me. But getting involved with Country Women magazine was part of the revolution, a huge part of the revolution for me. I didn't know anything about feminism. I knew nothing of that whole revolution going on. And then I began to learn in Albion because I found out that there were consciousness-raising groups, and I had no idea what on earth, what does that mean? And I was scared, but I went. And there were women talking to each other about pretty much anything and everything, and they were friendly and they were nice, and I didn't feel like running away and hiding. That was the beginning of a really, really monumentally meaningful, wonderful time of learning how fabulous people are, and that they liked me, and that I liked them. It was just fabulous, absolutely. I couldn't wait to go to the meetings. Then Country Woman magazine was born out of that. We gave each other jobs to make the magazine in the beginning because none of us knew what we were doing. But the way we worked together was absolutely wonderful. Again, it was like everybody respected each other automatically. It wasn't like power struggles and all the stuff that I associated with whatever. Not much, but what my experiences theretofore wouldn't have led me to be a part of a collective making a magazine. And here I was, you know.
How did that magazine get published?
I think we called on the connections each of us had with other people living communally or in the country or living the lifestyle that we were focusing on. And so that our list of people to contact and let know was put together from just all of our knowing. I do vaguely remember that we put ads in a couple of New Age magazines and stuff saying that here was this other magazine. And much to our surprise, we started getting a lot of people interested in subscribing. And part of the collective was in charge of getting the magazines printed and mailed out. And part of the collective had to do with creating the content and putting it all together. And the editorial collective is what I worked with the most and found the most exciting and fun and challenging. I miss it still. Yeah, I do.
How long was that magazine in production?
Oh, yoy, I should know that. I'm going to guess. I think it was probably 15 to 20 years. In fact, when I visited my youngest son, who now lives in Vermont, they took us to visit some wonderful old farmers that they love dearly. And we were sitting around having cider and homemade bread and all the good stuff. And I looked up and went, hey, there's Country Women. You know, I said something to the wife, and she said, oh, we love that magazine. It was like, oh, how can it be this good, you know? It was just wonderful.
Did your kids go to whale school?
My oldest son, Salmon, he had been named Andrew, but he started a trend in our family of changing names since everybody else was doing it. Actually, when we bought the land, he found out that there were salmon spawning in the creek at the bottom of our land. And for days and days and days, he virtually lived down there. He named all the salmon and where they were and, you know, how they dug their little nests and so forth. He just became intimate with them. And he came home one day and said, I'm changing my name. I said, oh, good. What are you changing your name to? Salmon. Okay. And he was Salmon. He's unfortunately not with us anymore. He was one of those people who, he knew what he wanted to do. He didn't have to monkey around. It was like he loved the ocean. He loved the water. He got himself into fishing, and that's what he did. He had to be out on the ocean. So he was, and that was great. Yeah. And my name came. how do I start this? It's long. I had a dream, and in the dream, I was a river. I wasn't a person. And I didn't remember ever having a dream in which I was other than a human, especially something not animal at all. I was a river. I was the water. I was the rocks in the water. I could feel myself going over rocks and around bends, and I could feel the grass touching the top, the surface. And it was so ecstatic. It was just absolutely gorgeous. It was like, okay, this is it. I'm a river. You know, I could feel fish swimming through me. And then at a certain point, I felt this an opening, a widening, as a river does when it goes out toward the sea. And it was scary. At that point, I was like, uh-oh, what's next? You know, and I just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And pretty soon, I wasn't a river anymore, but I was still water. And then it's hard for me to remember this. What happened was I looked up in the sky, and the sky was a strange color. And there was a little sign hanging in the sky that said, "It's your name, stupid." Can you believe? I mean, that's where I got that name. Pretty cool.
So that leads me to ask, when the peyote rituals were happening, were you taking part in that? And that must have been a new, if you were, that must have been a new experience for you.
Utterly new. Oh, yes, I was taking part in them. I remember clearly when we received an invitation from Table Mountain, we had heard that they were doing rituals that were based on some Native American or something, but that's all we knew. And no, we were told, too, that they were very strict. Don't go unless you're really serious. Okay. Then we got an invitation to come, and it was very specific. It said we had to come in time to do the sweat lodge first and be clean. Everybody did. We had to be prepared to sit all night, not move. Couldn't talk to other people at all, except when it was our turn to pray. But you didn't interact throughout the circle. All that stuff we learned about. We knew nothing, but we went. Not everybody. Quite a few of us went. Salmon went. Yes, he did. And that was the first of many, many rituals that we did together. It wasn't difficult, really. It sounded difficult, but in that spirit and with that medicine, it was anything but difficult. It was blessed. I remember looking up and thinking, this is how God sees things. And I'm not a religious person, but that's how that thought came through. As just whole and radiant, wonderful beings, you know, all of the judgments that can come up and all of the fears and inadequacies that can come up, they just went, whoosh, they were gone. And we were just in the midst of holiness, is what it felt like. So we did that for quite a few years. I couldn't put a number on it, but it was the center of my spiritual life for a number of years, yes.
Did you discover something about yourself that you hadn't understood in the process of that?
Good question. I discovered that I had been living a life without a very crucial factor being conscious to me. I hadn't really any relationship with my spiritual self I had long before, but not as an adult. And that was enormous, enormous. Oh my God, you don't have to believe in God, you don't have to do this, you can just be there with other beings who are equally blessed and rejoice. And that was the gift. It still is the gift. When I come back, sometimes I get to come when there's a ritual. And I love it. I wish I could find it in Vermont, but I haven't. And I don't know that I will. So I have to make it happen in funny other ways. Make something like that happen.
Mm. When you were here as a young woman and a member of a commune, did you have any memorable experiences with the people who lived here already who were receiving you?
Yes, there were two bachelor farmers who lived pretty much in the middle of what became Salmon Creek Farm, no on one edge. They'd been here since, I think it was 1912. They had been fishermen in the Bay Area and then left and came here, the Ham brothers. And they were just two of the dearest, sweetest people you ever would know. And they loved all the boys. So they started inviting the boys to come and play softball in their big field on Saturdays and other times. But basically Saturdays they got to go and watch cartoons on television, which of course we didn't have, and play baseball. And they were, I don't know, they were just those down home, not laid back. I mean, they built the whole darn farm and, you know, farmed it and gardens and animals, sheep, ran sheep for a long, long time. But they were of such integrity and cooperativeness. They kept offering, you know, anything. They obviously were hungry for connection with neighbors, and I don't think they had connected with other neighbors, even though they had been there a long time and the other neighbors had too, but it didn't feel like they had much other connection. So we all, not all, most of us really loved the fact that we could just walk up the hill and stop in anytime and see if they needed anything. And that was the most important one to me. Bill and Emil.
Did you have a sense when you were coming into Fort Bragg or coming into Albion of being looked on as the other, of being an interloper, a hippie, someone who was not particularly welcome?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. It never was nasty. It never got to that. Close a couple of times with people who were just like, wanted to shake you off, you know. One neighbor way down at the other end of the road definitely was made it clear. She said, you don't belong here. I was not somebody who could stand up to that and argue it through. I just wouldn't have done it, and I didn't. But I remember being stunned, being shocked, yeah.
Is there a time, a moment that, if you think back now, is emblematic of the best of what happened here for you?
Oh, what a great question. A moment that was emblematic. I know there is. I hope I find it. Well, what's coming up is I decided to try acid, which I had not. I never was much of a dope person, but this was reputed to be excellent quality and trustworthy, and a trustworthy person had some if I wanted to try. And true to my form, I decided to do it by myself. And fortunately, it worked out very well. And I took it in the meadow, not just up a little bit above where we lived. And I don't know what would have been there if I had not taken the acid, but it was kind of like in the peyote circle where everybody was God. In this situation, I just sat in the meadow and went, everything is God. Every blade of grass, everything. And it always struck me as funny that I would say is God, because I didn't have that in my life, or didn't know it if I did. And suddenly, here's everything being so radiantly holy. And, oh, I think I never did realize how deeply true that was. I didn't until then. The light of that came through. Yeah.
And then conversely, was there a downside? Was there a time or an aspect that was dark?
Yes, more than one, but the one that comes up is I got overly involved in my relationship with Robert and the college, and therefore not being with the commune as much as I intended to. I'd be down at the college, and we used to take, he and I led college kids on wilderness trips for I don't know how many years, but quite a while. And I loved that. I loved going to the wilderness, you know. But I wasn't there for my kids very much. And I just sort of put it out of my mind. I said, oh, they're big enough and they've got all the other people to relate to and they don't just have a nuclear family, so this is a good thing, and, you know, rationalized it. But one time Josh, who was his sixth grade teacher, said, every class has one. And Josh is the class crap detector. And he still is the class crap detector. But the crap that he was ready to tell me was, he said, you're not a mother anymore. He said, you used to be a good mother, but you're not anymore. So that sunk in. And it took a long time to come around to where we really can be in love with each other again.
On a whole nother note, did you have any sense of the counterculture activity that was happening inland?
I knew it was happening. I didn't go there hardly at all, but United Stand, we did all work together on that, if not over there. We were very, very aware that we were all in it together and felt connected that way. And there was Robin. There was a woman I got to know through a training we did together. And I heard a lot of their struggles, the specificity of their struggles from her. But other than that, I didn't feel that connected with it. I guess I just was on the coast. But I was glad that we were all doing it, and not just my our little selves. Yeah.
And as you look back on this experience of being here for so many years and such formative years, how did the fact that you came here, you came to San Francisco in 1968, and then you came up here to Fort Bragg a year or so later and stayed. How did that shape you? How did that impact who you've become?
Well, as I say, I was very shy and pretty much a loner growing up. I'm suddenly remembering the day, I hadn't been in this area long at all. We went to the town, to Mendocino, and I just stood outside of the little church that became Corners and watched people come and go. And I became entranced and enchanted with the fact that people seemed really genuinely glad to see each other, which felt miraculous. And people were dressed all differently. I mean, I grew up in the 50s with gray and navy blue and just so and seam straight and all of that. And here were all these people dressed in God knows what, and they looked just perfectly fine, you know, to me and to each other. And that was astounding. And not only were they tolerant, but they were enjoying this vast difference in appearance and behavior. That was so revolutionary, and it got into me. I didn't stop judging, but I got to notice it, you know, in myself when a judgment would come up. I was like, why are you doing that? You know, what's that good for? Well, yeah, ego, oh, great.
Once you left the commune, what did you do with your life? What have you done? I mean, what have you continued to do?
Once I left the commune, okay, Dan, my youngest, was a musician, still is a musician, and he's the one that I went to Vermont to live near when they were starting their family. He did not want to be living way the heck out on Middle Ridge because there's all the rehearsals and back and forth and school buses, and he hated that. And he really gave me a job. He said, you got to find us a place in town. And so his dear friend, another musician, a girl, said, you know what? There's an old workshop out behind our house. I'll talk to Mom and we'll see if we can't fix it up for you guys. So lo and behold, there's this old funky workshop. And her mother said, yes, we could do it. We could fix it up. And we could use in the facilities, the bathroom in the house and the shower and all that kind of stuff, which was pretty nice of her. She didn't know if I could handle a hammer or anything else. And I wasn't great at it, but I couldn't have built something from the ground up at that point. But I knew how to patch things up and put in a window here and a door there and so forth. So we had our little, we called it our little townhouse, put in a wood stove, got firewood, and that was it. And we lived there for quite a while, 3 years, I think, until she had other things going on in her life. And that ended and had to do it again, so I fixed up another old building. So it was a matter of just kind of finding my way. I didn't have a vision or a plan. It was just like, oh, we need to find another place, so we'll find another place. And in those days, there still were places, you know, that you could find and negotiate for. And I enjoyed that. I did. Yeah.
And when did you leave Mendocino County?
When did I leave Mendocino County? That's when I went to Vermont, yeah.
What has filled your life in those ensuing years from probably the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s?
Well, a number of things, but I'll speak to what intrigues me right now. And that is, I live in a senior building in right in Burlington. And I thought, oh, I can't do that. I never lived in any town or city. I got to be in the woods or something very rustic. And this is not. This is a 9-story building, and there's 105 elders living there. And it certainly has its challenges. And I really didn't think I could do it. And I don't know what shifted. Maybe I wanted to make sense to myself. You're living here. Are you going to live here and hate it? Are you going to live here and not hate it? Do something better. And I didn't really hate it that much. I mean, of course, there's individuals that are, you're not going to be, et cetera, et cetera. But what I've come to most recently is it's another one of these experiences. It's like God is there. And I consider my work right now just being with people who need somebody to be with them and finding all of these treasures who live around and right there where I live and finding things to do with them that they can do, even if they're, you know, wheelchair bound or unable to take part in any significant way, just to be there with somebody it's amazing. It's everything, you know, and I just want to communicate that to people, that I don't have to go join some big cause. I think that the world needs people to be with its seniors as much as it needs anything else. I'm happy that I'm in that place and can be there myself and can be with all the others who are there and want somebody to be with. You know? So that's the main thing I learned. Yeah.
Why is it important, or why did it matter that this Back to the Land movement happened here, that this influx of people came and did what they did? Why is it important? Is it important to reflect on that?
Good question. Well, I think because things needed to change, at least in my view, things needed to change. People weren't happy doing their 9-to-5 jobs. Some were, some weren't. I know I'm projecting some of this as mine. It just seemed like such a dismal, stultifying way to work. Every day you go to work, you go, you build a house, and you need a bigger house, so you work more, and then it keeps on going. And is this what we want to do? Is it really? It wasn't what I wanted to do, even when I had no idea there was anything else to do. But it's like, can't we explore that, the possibility that there's something else that's better? And then bingo, up comes guess who? I guess that's my answer. Yeah, I think it's true now. People are miserable in their work, and yet there's this belief, you got to have this, you got to have it. And who's putting out these you gottas, you know?
Is there anything else you want to say as you think back on this experience and how it's shaped you, how it's affected you, and how it's affected this place? And what it has meant to you?
Well, it's meant a great deal. It's meant that I feel like I got my life here. I was just sort of surviving, doing pretty well. But in terms of really ultimate satisfaction, joy, and a sense of that I'm worth my while being here. And I didn't know that about myself before. So yeah, I think that I lived most of my life, I know I did, in fear and being self-protective and all. And the way this place is, the land itself, the edge and the sky and the cliffs, all of that is to me an embrace. It's like, that's how it felt to me to be here. It's like there was a safe and wonderful embrace rather than a place to kind of, okay, we're... what am I going to do? How am I going to make my living? It was like, that's going to take care of itself. You don't have to worry about all that. Just, you need a job, get a job. You know? Am I making sense? Yeah, okay. So yeah, I feel like it's been the gift of life, and I never expected it could really happen. It is.
Did your father ever come out here?
No, unfortunately, my father died of a heart attack at 59, which is... big, big, big loss. I knew he'd love it. I knew my mother would hate it, and I knew he would love it. And my mother got to see it. She did. She stayed in Salmon's cabin for a night, which was not a happy experience for anybody involved. But everyone lived. But yeah, I wish my dad could have known Tom and all everybody and been here and seen this place. He would love this place.
Thank you so much. We just heard from River, who gave us a taste of how Mendocino County and the Women's Liberation Movement helped shape her. These short excerpts of Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Oral Histories of Mendocino County, air Thursdays during the news hour. To hear the half-hour program with River, tune in Thursday at 3:30 p.m. If you missed River's full interview, you can find it on the KZYX website, along with more than a dozen other Back to the Land stories. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, Story Center, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.